Hello. Welcome back to Inspiring African Travel. This is James here. And this is our official introduction to the third fundraising beneficiary for our year raising money for the three little projects in Africa in Jules's memory. So welcome back. And it's been a bit of a break. Apologize for the wait. We've been running around in Botswana. Lots of work going on, but today is the day that we announce Dr. Tempi Adams' project that's taking place here in Botswana. She's a really longtime friend of mine and of Julia's as well. And today's episode, we actually talked to her about where the funds that we're raising from this Inspiring African Travel fundraising year will be going to for her work in Botswana. But before I do that, I just want to recap where we are with the fundraising so far for this year, because we're almost approaching halfway through the year and really chuffed to have already raised $6,500 or thereabouts, thanks to some amazing donations from lots of friends, contacts, and even people we don't know. It's been incredibly heartwarming. But the donations have unfortunately slowed up after the initial push, and we'd really love to keep it going. So anything you can do to share the projects that we're involved in and to encourage others to engage, people who know Julia, people that it might resonate with, the link to donate is on our homepage, inspiringafricantravel.com, and it's really easy to donate from the homepage. I'd also like to add that anybody who is based in the UK or elsewhere who would like to make a corporate donation to a registered charity so that you can get the details of the registered charity and claim back the gift aid, we have established an official partnership with the Education Development Projects Trust. You're most welcome to donate to Inspiring African Travel through them. They're a registered UK charity, and the EDB Trust actually channel the funds to the Awutu Winton Senior School in Ghana. That's the project in Ghana that we're supporting, the school, the senior school. And as of last month, I have also been entrusted to be the trustee as well with them. I've joined the trustee committee. And so it's really nice that it's doing a full circle. So please, if you're interested in using the charity to donate to our projects, then let us know. Just send us an email. All the details are on our website, or just drop us a note in our on our socials. But for now, let's go back to Mound Town, the gateway to the Okavango Delta in Botswana. It's a really important topic for us, and especially because we're involved in safaris. The very reason people come on safari in Africa is because of the epic wildlife that we have there. But until we find more ways to help manage the challenges that free roaming wildlife presents to local people, it's always going to be a huge challenge. And that's a huge part of Tempi's work. So I hope you're going to be keen to participate in this journey as Tempi literally gets this project off the ground now. Real opportunity to be a part of it from the beginning going forward. And I also hope you enjoy our little moment of zen and tranquility before our chat. If you like it, maybe we'll make it a regular occurrence. Okay. Over to Botswana. Thanks, and talk soon. Okay, we'd like to start this session just by closing your eyes.
Do I have to put my coffee down?
Yeah. Take a deep breath through your nose and out through your mouth. three times, all the way to the top. One more. So we're going to start this spiritual guided journey. You can open your eyes. Okay, how do you feel?
Refreshed.
Yeah, good.
Nice.
A deep breath is like a massage for the inside of your body.
A massage for the brain.
We want to start off, if you don't mind, there's so much to talk about. Start off by saying how much, what are you going to be doing in the next, let's call it 18 months. Your next project, what are you going to be doing, and how can people joining the Inspiring African Travel fundraising year help you achieve what you want to do?
Golly, just starting with the biggest question.
Yep, sorry.
Going in hard and strong and fooling me with your breathing.
Just a short, sharp version, and then we can go into it in detail.
What I hope to be able to achieve in the next 18 months is I really want to understand the human side of the human wildlife complex story. And I think we understand, I'm not saying by any means we fully understand the wildlife side of it, but I think we really, in order to create any kind of meaningful change and create management that has any kind of impact, you really, really got to understand people. Because that's where the change comes from. So I'm really trying to embark on really kind of understanding where people's ideas and perceptions have come from with wildlife, and what their willingness is to change, what their willingness is. Can we learn some insights that we don't know about how to solve these problems that are already there, but we just need to delve into it? But I think people and the human story of human wildlife conflict needs to be told, and we've got to do that by collecting data.
Great.
And that's what the mission's going to be.
Great mission. And how can everybody help?
So, wonderfully, I can't do it by myself. and this has got to be, obviously, there's limitations in what I can do. I don't speak the local languages, unfortunately. I do very, very badly. So I need an assistant and I need a translator to help pioneer this with me. And that's what Inspiring African Travel is going to be going towards.
Awesome.
Yeah, and that's going to be the champion, that individual will become the champion for the research in these communities.
Exactly that, your local ambassador.
Exactly.
Great. I hope we can also help maybe find that person as well.
It's very much, though, that sort of work is teamwork. Mm-hmm. And it's about making sure we have the right person, so there's the right level of comfort and trust.
Yeah,
I think that's key. So yeah. It is a very special person that we're going to be looking for.
Great. Okay, well, that's brilliant. So this is how we're going to help you. You've got research permits, which is fantastic news.
Yep.
I'm literally buzzing for you.
Yeah, I know. It's
and
exciting.
It's well deserved. It means that you, Dr. Tempe Adams, have got a good reputation in the country for what you've done over the last few years, not more than a few years, in terms of working with communities and helping wildlife and communities live together. And I think, let's break it down. Okay, so the wildlife in Botswana is an incredible asset. We understand that people come to visit Botswana from overseas, and it's the second biggest contributor to the economy here.
Yeah.
And they're coming to see, let's talk elephants, but I know that you're going to be covering all sorts of wildlife, but they are coming essentially for the wildlife and the wilderness areas.
Yeah.
At the same time, local communities, people that live here, they have a different story to some degree because they have to live amongst the wildlife and it presents challenges.
Yeah.
And one of the big challenges that nobody seems to be paying a great deal of attention to is the damages, the challenges of road accidents.
Yeah.
And road kills, and not just the wildlife that are getting harmed and killed, but the people.
Yeah.
And that is crucial.
Absolutely.
Like, that's got to come to.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It is, and it's such an obvious sort of in your face form of conflict. So obviously, a lot of the work is going to be focused on, simply that, understanding what the struggles and difficulties or maybe not even the struggles and difficulties, but what it is like to live in these wildlife areas. Because Botswana is famous for, you know, their protected areas are not fenced, so wildlife can still roam free, and our human population's increasing. We're getting more, the towns are expanding. Villages are becoming towns now, which is a great thing. You know, we don't want to stop development, of course not. I mean, we need to advocate for it. But I think Botswana is in this really great position where the population is still so small, we can still have this really good impact. We can really plan successfully, but we can't do it if we don't really understand how to and how to plan efficiently and effectively. And a big thing that I think has become apparent over this decade is, obviously, I've previously focused a lot on urban wildlife and understanding how urban wildlife is adapting to people. And what I've really seen is, very simply, we have a lot of road accidents, and that is such a direct conflict. So sometimes we think about crop raiding and these sort of big classic forms of very harsh conflict and people's livelihoods being taken, but literally people's lives die on the road and wildlife. And I think that's something so simple for us to try and really understand, pinpoint the hotspots, work out what are the main animals being taken, where are we having the highest number of accidents, and then we can really implement proper road management strategies. But you need the baseline data to also understand that, you know? And it's something that's been done very successfully in Australia, throughout North America, and parts of Europe even. And there has been, they've been trying to get it going in South Africa, but I think it's something that all countries can kind of implement. It's so applicable globally. And obviously, we have some pretty big animals that can create accidents.
Pretty bad accidents.
Yeah, and it can be, absolutely horrific. So it's about trying to understand that.
Data.
Yeah.
You see, even in my job, I've learned that you have to make decisions based on data. Which is sometimes not the funnest part.
I love it. No, but I think.
No, I love just. Yeah. I've got a good feeling like this is where the market is going, and this is what we should be doing. And then your boss goes, "Have you checked the stats?"
Exactly. I know. So we do need. Well, unfortunately, it's terrible when you do have people that make decisions without data to back them, and that's what's gotten ourselves into a bit of trouble, I think, in the past.
Yeah, well, and as a scientist, I think.
Yeah.
You really want.
We love a bit of data. It's true.
Okay.
It's true. Yeah.
So, and presumably, technology nowadays with mobile phones and things.
Yeah.
I can imagine in Europe, Australia, small but precious wildlife like hedgehogs and echidnas and things like that.
It's funny. I mean, I obviously grew up in Australia, and the roadkill, the amount of roadkill we have in Australia is astronomically high.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where you're so desensitized, you don't even really notice that it's there. And it wasn't until I was sort of chatting to visitors from Africa over in Australia, and they just went, "Wow, you guys have a load of roadkill there." They were and a lot of the native species I've seen were roadkill.
Yep.
And that's so sad, you know, and something that needs to change. And I never want, it would be very sad to think the same thing could be happening here as well. And, you know, birds are still roadkill. We have critically endangered birds being frequently killed on the roads. I think the biggest one that always gets me is when I see wild dogs on the road that have been killed. I mean, that's just, there's so much effort going into conserving them and their population. And then to see, it's incredibly upsetting. So if we can do anything to try and counter that, and it is, again, it's not just about wildlife, it's people's lives.
Yep.
And let's do it.
So let's present a summary now of where we are. So essentially, you're presenting to the government and the people of Botswana to say, right, one of the challenges that we have with wildlife and communities and people are road kills and road accidents. But the general aim of the project is another piece of the puzzle in helping human and wildlife coexistence so that we can still maintain good, healthy populations of wildlife, stop the depletion of some of our precious wildlife, and continue working in harmony. So I've written down here the title of your research project.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. What is the title?
Not because it's difficult to remember. Understanding the dynamics and processes of human-wildlife conflict to facilitate coexistence within conflict hotspots in Botswana. You can't deny it. It's a riveting title, Thames.
Oh, thank you. It's very encompassing of a lot of different things.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I've noticed. And and very important. And that's why I genuinely believe that what you're doing is great, because it's another piece of a crucial puzzle. So you're going to go out there and just help the general mission that our country and challenge has with regards to human and wildlife conflict. Now, talk us through, I know that there's no timeline to this project because we've got obviously goals. How are you going to go about starting to do this? Talk us through the very basics of the different stages of the plan. So beginning, you start, you get the data, in the middle, and then you're finished and there's no community wildlife conflict anymore.
Yeah, the dream, which never happens. I mean, I think that's the thing with conflict and coexistence. We've been chatting about it. You know, I've been working on it for over a decade.
Yeah.
There's no quick solution.
No.
And I think exactly what we're talking about are the things that we haven't really looked at. So, but it does take time, and it's about planting seeds. And I've been planting seeds for years now. But it's about the first thing is finding this key person.
Yep.
And that can be an ongoing sort of thing that comes about.
Yeah.
But then it's just, so for the roadkill, I'm trying to create an app or an information collecting device, let's say an app, that anyone can report roadkill incidents in. So it makes it instantly like a citizen science community driven sort of initiative. So I actually need to have the app built.
Love it.
Yep.
Okay, any good app builders and contacts out there?
Give us a shout out. Mm. Yeah, so I've looked into lots of different avenues. I am trying to use something that's free and then potentially can be replicated in any community. So and then we could lead the charge in training people up and how to set this up in different countries.
Mm.
And that's what I'm kind of chatting to them about right now. Obviously everything you want to use, you want to try and make it. I can be the guinea pig and then hopefully it can be used in elsewhere.
Yeah.
But that's literally where we're starting with the roadkill things. But at the same time, I've already done a sort of call out to the community. If you see anything on these specific roads, send me a WhatsApp.
And then you're popping it in an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Yeah, just start. I'm never going to say no to any data coming in. You know, you never would. So at a very basic level, you know, that's what where we're starting at with that. Hopefully we want to honestly have that up and running and collecting data in the next month.
Epic. All right. Yep. So then 2 years, let's say 2 years, 3 years, whatever, you've got your first set of data available.
Yeah.
And you can probably already see we've got a problem
exactly.
here, we've got a problem there.
Yeah.
What do you do?
So once you can pinpoint what the problem is and what the species are, then you can actually come up with some kind of solutions. Because I think roadkill in... such a great topic, isn't it? Roadkill in towns would be very different than roadkill on highways, for instance. But even the species, right? So you would need different solutions. You can't put speed bumps on a highway.
No.
Right? You could, I mean, maybe they do it in some places, but
well,
it would
we could just put more potholes.
It could potentially create more accidents,
yes.
Right? So it's about being strategic. Maybe you zone the roads. Maybe mm-hmm. you change the rules and regulations. I mean, we have buses and trucks aren't supposed to, but buses that can go at nighttime.
Mm.
If all our accidents are happening at nighttime, for instance, that's a really good indicator. What do we need to... So it helps you actually just pinpoint what exactly... How you can actually make decisions specifically for those hotspot areas. You know, I was reading an incident where there was consistent donkeys being hit and causing huge accidents. People were dying. And then they simply went and put glow-in-the-dark collars around the donkeys in that area.
Mm.
Instantly, Brilliant. Road accidents reduced. So sometimes it can be a bit of a quirky solution to this, but we don't know until we have that data. So it would be using that information and working with Roads Department and the Wildlife Department to come up with those solutions, those really sometimes logical solutions, specific for those conflict hotspots.
Yep. Nice. Actionable solutions. Fluorescent, collars for all elephants in Botswana.
Could you imagine? Okay. But it is interesting how the solutions can be, you know, it is slightly out of the box, but it could have a huge impact. I'm not saying we're going to go and put collars on elephants.
The people joining, a lot of people are involved in tourism and love Africa and want to understand how they are making an impact on conservation and how this relates. And I think this is really important for people to understand, is that education is a big part of what you're going to be doing out there. And I think there are certain pieces of the research permit that you've got that need to come into place with regards to actually physically engaging in educational projects for kids and stuff. But a great deal of what you're going to be doing is being out there in the communities and creating awareness, that's fair to say, right?
Creating discussions. Yeah, I think conversations and learning. I mean, I think the biggest part of working with people in conservation, I think, is listening. There's a lot of power in just listening, asking and listening, and really making people feel heard, I think, is so important, because the answers are often there. But I think, you know, the sexy idea in conservation is often very wildlife focused, understandably. And as I said, that is really important. But understanding the people and who's actually involved on the ground in day-to-day living in a wildlife area is fundamental. So yes, it's not necessarily, you know, we're not going out there and putting on a GPS collar on, you know, which is often a really sexy idea of conservation and is really helpful and is really valuable, definitely. But this is sometimes much more complicated, but it is actually really necessary to actually talk to people and hear what they have to say, because often I think there's frustration, and this is globally, between sometimes, you know, sometimes you're told what to think versus what actually people do think.
Yeah. Well, you told me that amazing story about the community that you went to visit and how you presented to them and said, hey guys, tell me what you know about elephants. Can you share that anecdote again?
Yeah, so I think it's been really interesting. You know, often when you do initially go in to a community and just sort of say, let's just sit around the room and tell me what have you heard of, or what anything you've heard about elephants. And obviously elephants are the big hot topic in Botswana, definitely. And it's interesting because a lot of people, because they don't necessarily know exactly what you're coming in to come and chat about, or, you know, they almost want to say the right things. So they say what they've read in newspapers, or they say what they've heard on the radio, or they say, it is really interesting. And it can be like literally like taglines, like elephants will damage all our crops. Elephants threaten our lives. Elephants.
People were literally putting their hands up and saying these things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, wow. Definitely. And that's really interesting. Mm. You know, that's a great starting point to start to work out, where's this coming from? Where are these ideas coming from? Is this really how people genuinely are feeling? Mm. Or is this more what they've been told to be feeling? Or, I mean, it's so complicated, right? And that's why we really want to try and understand it more. Where do these ideas really formulate? Is it from personal experience with those animals? Or is it from what they've heard from their brother who lives in another district? Is it, you know, I think it's really, that's really, really key in telling the whole story.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no other way to put it, but without the custodians of the wildlife in Southern Africa, East Africa, all over Africa, without buy-in and understanding and the ability to relate to the importance and how precious wildlife is, it's not going to work, is it? Mm. It's really not going to work. And I don't want to go into this whole story of the recent press that Botswana presented to Europe and the UK. The argument was, hey guys, you know, we still have the greatest population of elephants here in this country, and in most parts of the West, it's been wiped out. And so it presents a real challenge for the communities here. So the work that you're going to be doing out there, engaging and helping, basically, and educating, is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to understand the challenges you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes not about numbers. you know, it's about much more than numbers of wildlife.
The numbers of wildlife that you have.
Which is what we seem to keep repeating.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be debated. I think we literally chatted about this in the last conversation we had, how people get so obsessed about numbers and carrying capacities and all these things. Why can't we talk about what people in the communities want to talk about and what they're experiencing? And what change do they really need to see? Because sometimes it's not money. There's also this assumption that sometimes it is money, but sometimes it's not money. Throwing money at the problem isn't always going to be the empowering solution. But I think that's, again, what we're trying to uncover and kind of figure out. What is the tangible solutions and how do people... That's the only way you're going to create any kind of policy and change that is really encompassing the people on the front lines.
Okay, so here we go. We've got data, we've got actionable solutions, and you're going to start off immediately already by creating conversation, awareness within the communities, which will be valuable input. And then let's talk about the actual key wildlife species that you're going to be working with. I know that you haven't limited yourself to elephants, but, and let's not, you've just said let's not talk about numbers, but a tremendous amount of elephants.
You're going to talk about numbers?
Tremendous amount of elephants in Botswana. And it is, going back to tourism and wildlife tourism, one of the key reasons why people come into Botswana to spend money on safari is to see these amazing animals. So,
definitely,
we need to make sure that all the issues relating to elephant and human conflict are somehow managed. Otherwise, it's going to be another big problem on our hands and it's going to keep becoming a problem.
Yeah.
So
this is a constant problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not going away.
So yeah. Big elephant, big animals, iconic species. Mm. Talk us through the issues and the accidents and the traffic-related issues. I know it might sound obvious, but can you explain?
Some of the simplest accidents that often happen is grass being really tall on the side of roads. And if you're going 120 kilometres an hour, I mean, with the wildlife that we have in these wildlife areas, it doesn't need to be just an elephant, a kudu or a zebra, anything can run out, you know. And our roads are, we're not a country with vast highways, multiple lanes.
Yeah, explain the roads. What are they
like? Yeah, we've just got simple, a lot of our national highways are just, you know, single lane highways. But obviously, they're quite high speed limits because people have got to get to A and B. But these highways transverse our forest reserves and our national parks in a lot of areas, which is obviously where we have our incredible wildlife population. So some of these accidents are simply from grass growing literally to the edge of the road. So how is anyone supposed to see any animals? How is the wildlife even meant to know there's a road there? Often you'll have bus accidents hitting elephants. You can have kudu jump out in front of lights quite often. Zebra, but buffalo, I think, are also some of the hardest, especially elephant and buffalo on the road. They're literally the colour of the road.
And their eyes are hard to reflect sometimes.
Absolutely.
To the wrong direction. Or...
Yeah. So, you know, it's a real hazard.
God, Tempe, just it's a horrendous thought of a bus of people. I mean, and the fatalities that presumably... Have you got any stats? Have you got any data at all in Botswana with regards to wildlife?
I purely have... Accidents? I mean, I think road department obviously literally have accidents recorded, obviously.
Yeah.
This is purely coming from me just living here through the years and seeing and hearing what I've heard. And I don't think any of us here know of people that have been in road accidents. We all know of someone here that's been in a road accident with wildlife here.
Do you know roughly what the numbers are with regards to fatalities and road accidents?
I have no idea, to be honest, yeah. And that's what we need to be changing.
Yeah.
Because we need to... And, I think some of the accidents are just... It's just a freak accident that maybe has happened, but I do think there's reoccurring patterns in certain areas, and that's what we would need to try and work out if we can try and reduce these fatalities in any way, shape or form. But I think it is, you know, when you're driving the roads in the UK, you think about road accidents you have and some of the animals that kill badgers and
deers.
You know, all deer, exactly. Imagine that to the scale that we have here. And that's what we're sort of dealing with.
Scary.
It is scary, and it's horrifically sad, you know. And that's why we need to be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Exciting, but daunting.
Yeah.
Let's talk some money now.
Oh, gosh, okay.
It's an exciting stage because you're the last piece of our fundraising year puzzle.
Yes.
We've already raised a little bit of money, which is great, and we want to raise a lot more.
Yeah.
So it's now opportunity. We've raised for the three projects just around £6,000. So let's call it $6,500.
Yeah.
So we've already got around $2,000 to get you going. And what are the basic, so that people can relate to how much money they can donate and where it will go? Roughly, what is it going to cost to have a field assistant? What are some of your expenses that you need to get you going, to get you out there?
Yeah, so I mean, the field, that's the thing about what I love about this initiative. You can directly get updates on the projects. You're directly having conversations with the people on the ground. There's no middleman, which I think is, well, you're our middleman, I suppose, which is...
You're part of your team.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is, though. It's such I don't know, I think about a lot of the different fundraising initiatives that happen globally, and I think sometimes people don't necessarily get that transparency, and that's why it is really exciting to be a part of something like this, and something I'm very grateful to have been selected to be a part of this. But, I mean, it's literally paying someone's salary. It's paying for them to buy groceries each week and pay their rent.
Amazing.
For the individual that we're going to be selecting. And it might be multiple individuals in the different areas. It depends, you know, we're kind of going to have to figure that out as we go along. So there might be two champions. But it would be literally paying their weekly salary.
Yeah, well, we ran the sums. We're looking at about $150 per week, possibly, to get you going, which would be pay somebody to be your interpreter and your translator and your ultimately your ambassador within the communities.
Yeah.
So that's so far enough to get you going for somebody for about 3 months. But of course there'll be fuel and everything. So
fuel is the big one because we've got to get to all the places.
Yeah. But if somebody was to donate $2,000, you'd be basically paying and covering the costs for your ambassador, for your translator to work with you for about 3 months, which is something that I feel is really incredibly valuable.
Absolutely.
Can imagine.
But I think what's the ultimate is it doesn't cost a huge amount of money to do this work, you know.
Mm.
It doesn't, you know, but it doesn't cost a huge amount to have a massive impact. But it's amazing when you do get that money, how far it can go. I think that's the key as well. It's just very exciting to kind of get the ball rolling.
Exactly. Find out what you'll discover out there.
Exactly.
So you sound very intelligent, Tempe. how did you get to where you are?
I ate my vegetables.
Doctor, you are a doctor. Actually know what you're talking about. You're a doctor,
not
a
medical doctor.
No. Have you, I think the coffee's kicked in. How did you get to where you are today? What's your inner, you know, people who haven't listened to episode 3 of series 1 where we introduced women in tourism.
Yeah.
And
if you haven't listened, listen to it. It was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
So glad.
And we were with Jules sitting in my precious car, in my precious happy space in Chobe National Park, where we've gone on many adventures together.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about Julia and your friendship and everything, but just for people who don't know you, as you get the light cast on
your head, sun's hitting my face.
How did you get to where you are today and in the position to do what you're about to do with regards to human wildlife conflict?
Yeah, so I predictably I studied environmental science in Sydney at the University of New South Wales. I'm still a lecturer with them. I'm still very active researcher with them, so they're a part of the collaboration on this project and this research. So I studied environmental science, and I actually then went on to get a scholarship for a PhD, and my PhD. I was always more drawn, I realized throughout my undergrad, I was very much drawn to problem-solving science. I like having a problem and then try and build some proper tangible outcomes out of it. So I think for that reason, I was always drawn to conflict and understanding conflict and conflict resolution for any wildlife. And I think elephants appeared to be a big one in Africa. So I did a number of different research internships in Africa throughout my undergrad, postgrad. And then I ended up ultimately doing a PhD in human-elephant conflict resolution. And it was based here in Botswana with a local NGO, Elephants Without Borders. So I did my PhD. And then out of my PhD, we kept the coexistence and conflict work going. So it's all just building on top of each bit of the piece of the puzzle, if that makes sense. So it's just been naturally evolving. So I finished my PhD, and then with Elephants Without Borders, we set up a human-wildlife coexistence project and then worked on that for a number of years. And then this is the next step in the puzzle. So now an independent researcher with the Okavango Research Institute, University of Botswana and UNSW. And yeah, just continuing it on. I've been working on conflict resolution now for over it's 12 years now.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Wow, you've got a lot of experience under your belt, and I can't think of a better person to get out there and do what you're doing now, which is great. And it was a real privilege to be out there and see you in your field, going out there and having
nice
those conversations. And
yeah,
you've done some tremendous work with EWB there. And I feel genuinely excited that you are, I know you've done a lot of groundwork and have got a lot of contacts in the industry, but you're starting a new project now, and I feel like we're part of it from the word go.
Yeah.
And so I hope that people that are listening to this and have an interest in what you're doing and the challenges that you're going to be facing and dealing with can go, right, yeah, let's join this journey and see where it goes and how we can help, because it would be amazing.
And definitely.
And of course, so many of those times and that we've enjoyed being out in Chobe and stuff were with Julia, who is the reason why we're sitting here now, is so that we can do this fundraising year and create something special, create a real difference in the places that she loved dearly.
Absolutely.
So much in Africa, and the people that she loved. And
what's your
lasting memory of Jules? What do you think?
I still remember, actually, even when we were out, I think one of my favorite visits out to the community when you guys were with us, when we were in Mchenji.
Mchenji in the Chobe enclave.
Yeah, and we were admiring all the conflict-free crops. And I remember having such a cool conversation. And it's just so nice for me when I can share that experience when you guys have the insight to chat to a farmer that's living alongside a wildlife corridor. So they have a lot of wildlife there, but they are successfully growing crops. But I do remember we had a really great spinach picking session with Mr. Spinach.
Spinach picking session. Sounds great.
It's actually, we had a lot of fun. You know, there's like a satisfaction with seeing a crop that has been grown, surrounded by wildlife, but it's successfully grown, hasn't been eaten by wildlife. That farmer feels so empowered. And Mr. Chabea, who we nicknamed Mr. Spinach because he was the most amazing spinach grower in Chobe, in Mchenji village at the time, going and picking the crops. And I remember Jules was so excited by this big bunch of spinach, and she kept buying more spinach. You had a lot of spinach when you guys went back with it. And you went back that night and actually
cooked an amazing dinner.
Yeah,
well, because Chobe Game Lodge was closed. It was COVID.
Oh my gosh.
Chobe Game Lodge was closed. My beloved Chobe Game Lodge. And it was amazing. Yeah. What a privilege to have in a hard time to be able to go back there. And we had the whole kitchen to ourselves.
Exactly.
And we had the whole national park to ourselves.
Yeah.
Oh. And we went back with bags of elephant conflict free spinach and cooked up the James Wilson pasta special. Yeah. What a great story.
Yeah. And that was really cool.
It is really cool when you
really
see
satisfying.
Everything
exactly
coming together.
And it sounds so silly, but it is so simple, but it is it's really exciting. I just remember Jules being so stoked to go and to cook up that spinach.
Yeah.
It's really seared in my mind.
Yeah.
That visit. Yeah.
Do you know what my memory is?
What's that?
Most of them are some of the adventures that we went together. But one of the last Instagram posts with Jules before she got sick and before things went haywire back in the UK, we went to Savuti together.
Yeah.
And it was hot. It was real hot.
I think it was October.
Yeah. And we got to Savuti Safari Lodge and we took a photo in the pool with the elephants behind us.
Yeah.
But that trip was so cool.
That was an amazing trip.
Three of us driving around. And my memory is when we were making sandwiches.
Oh, my gosh.
Jules was a very precise sandwich maker.
Jules is a very, very good sandwich maker. Let's just start with that. But the speed at which the sandwiches are made was something to behold. Because I remember we did have a really short amount of time. It was like a hot 24-hour turnaround.
Yeah, but we weren't in a rush. You had to drive back to...
You weren't in a rush. I was in a rush, yeah. But I really wanted this wonderful-looking sandwich that was being created. But it was the funniest process to watch. Because we were also, it was COVID as well. So we had, again, the whole Savuti Safari Lodge kitchen to ourselves, which actually was a blessing and a curse, but it meant we didn't know where anything was.
No.
So the process was just, I mean, we were having a great fat chat in the kitchen, but yeah.
Well, what made me chuckle the most was that, because I know you really well, and Jules was quite blissfully unaware. Mm. That you were sort of going, I could see your body language. And you were like, and then Jules was like, would you like some gherkin temps with your thing? And you're like, whatever. You know, like you were just like,
She's
that sandwich, oh, Jules, that sandwich looks great. That just perfect.
But like, wait, it's not finished. wait, there's some more.
Great, my Jules.
Oh, dear. Well, but, I mean... best sandwich maker.
Yeah, no, quality.
I've got to say, it was a brilliant sandwich. A
little bit of mustard stroked on the top of the sandwich, gherkins.
Mm. It had a lot in it.
Ham. Yeah, a lot of ham. Well, I hope you enjoyed it when you eventually got it. Well, thanks for being such an amazing friend to her and sharing. And you've been great support to me in the whole process and everything. I think that Botswana became a place that she learned to love a great deal. And I think it's an amazing thing about a relationship is that when you get together with someone and fall in love, you start to understand and share their own passions. And I love Botswana dearly.
Yeah.
It's just being here in this garden, listening to the birds, I just feel at one in this place. And she shared that with me and my friends as well, like you. And now that her fundraising year add value to what you're going to be doing up there.
It's a whole full story, yeah. I think it was amazing as a friend. We all know your deep love of Chobe.
Mm.
And I think it was so important when you two were really getting to know each other that she wanted to understand this love of Chobe.
Mm.
And watching the two of you and watching you introduce it to her and see her love and understanding grow for it was really cool to be able to witness and share and be a part of.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing that we're now doing this project in the name of Jules. I mean, it's actually like the ultimate honor, and I'm very, very chuffed to be a part of it.
For great. Sure. Thanks, so are we. All right, now's our time. Going to put you on the spot.
The hot seat questions.
Yeah, the hot seat questions. Well, there you have it, everybody. It's going to be hopefully this has been a juicy episode. And I would like you to join our journey. Please donate to Inspiring African Travel. Be a part of our fundraising year. This is our opportunity to help communities that are affected by the wildlife that we love so much and that is a part of my industry and a part of reasons why people come to Botswana. And I think that as much as this is about wildlife, a crucial part of what you're going to be doing is about people and helping communities.
Absolutely. And it's really exciting because we're starting from the very beginning. So please join us on this journey, because it is going to be a journey. And we want you to feel like you're part of the team. So, yeah, join us.
Nice one. Thank you.